Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature. This is your host, Tom Majeure, and we are continuing our series on migration. I have Dr. Gordon Atkins, the nature guy at Campus Abo at Grayling, Michigan. Welcome back, Dr. Atkins.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed this series. And Dr. Atkins, we have listeners who remember these interviews and talk to me and share their positive experiences.
Well, that's great. It's good to hear.
Well, we're going to continue. We did the Springtime series, and now we're moving pretty much into the fall. We're going to have a fall bird series, but we're not talking about birds today. What are we talking about?
That's correct. Today, we're going to talk about monarch butterflies because they do migrate, and we're very lucky in Michigan to have them here, and they're not here all the time. They disappear, and then it seems like they come back, but that's an interesting story we'll get into.
Well, Dr. Atkins, will you lead us out in a word of prayer?
Sure. Our Father in heaven, we just thank you for the creation that has been laid out in front of us so that we have something to look at and learn. And this is your artwork. So by learning about your creation, we're learning something about you. And we just thank you for that. Be with us during this time together, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Dr. Atkins, it's amazing that us amateur scientists can learn just by observing.
Oh, yeah. There's just so much out there. And you know, the color, the design, the patterns, if you really start paying attention, there's just so much detail. And that's just with our eyes. You get into a microscope and look even more, or a telescope and look further away. The detail in this universe is amazing. It tells us something about our God.
There's a creator.
There is.
Dr. Atkins, I just two thoughts about sitting and observing, and that's almost a lost art, would you say?
It is, actually, and in outdoor ed circles, one of the things we focus on is doing that, spending some time listening, watching, maybe journaling, drawing diagrams to pay attention. And even if you're a horrible artist, I have many students say, I can't draw. It's not the drawing that counts. It's the time you spent looking at what you're drawing. The drawing is just kind of keeping you engaged. But in this world of a quick snapshot and file it away with another million files that you never get to look at again, you don't learn as much as you do if you just stop and pay attention.
Well, and I want to just pause on this, is that on a couple occasions, I just sat on my back porch, and probably in the springtime, and I was amazed at what I saw. And it was interesting. I think I was actually reading something, and while I was reading, birds would fly up. And I was amazed how many birds just came by my deck, and I observed. It was just wonderful.
Just staying still for a bit and becoming part of the ecosystem, you get to see what's really going on. It's a lot of fun.
They come to you even though you're just sitting there. The other thing I was thinking about, and that was leading into this, Dr. Atkins, is that I noticed that each fall, we take a Labor Day weekend, a long weekend, and it almost invariably every Labor Day, we see monarchs that are migrating.
That's about the right time. It can vary from year to year a little bit, depending on the low temperatures at night particularly. But they're tied to, we'll get into this a little later, they're tied to the day length. That's a cue for them. So it's not surprising that you're able to see that on a certain date, and you're always seeing them in that location because they're pretty much a creature of habit.
So we're talking about migrations and monarchs. Now, you said we're really privileged to see monarchs here in Michigan. Who gets to see the monarchs migrate? Is this?
Well, it's hard sometimes to see the monarchs migrating. They live in a wide area, the Great Lakes Basin, the states in the U.S. and provinces in Canada that border the Great Lakes are all sort of central to the monarch breeding grounds.
So going further west, there would be less?
There are fewer of them west. Now, there are some monarchs that actually migrate to the California coast because it doesn't freeze there usually. And so there's a small population that sort of migrate southwest and hang up there. And if you've been to California, even in the winter, there's some flowering shrub somewhere. So there's a food supply for them. But pretty much the rest of the continent, or the country at least, is not suitable for butterflies year-round, and so they land up wanting to go to Mexico.
Well, I'm sure our listeners learned something here. If you've lived here much of your life, you just thought that everybody has monarchs.
No, we're lucky, and monarchs have struggled for a bit, and a couple of years ago, we had very few monarchs across the nation. They had a bad winter, and didn't do so well, but they seem to be rebounding, and that's encouraging.
Really good news. Well, tell us about this migration. We used to think that they went south and they came north, and...
Well, they do leave in the fall, and then they show up in June or July, and so most moths and butterflies will hibernate, or they may lay their eggs and die, and then in the spring, the larvae will grow, and so most moths and butterflies don't migrate. But the monarch is pretty much an exception to that. And it's not clear why they're the only ones that do that, but it's what they do. So they leave here in the fall, and that's when you can see them, like you were referring to over Labor Day in the UP, did you say?
Actually, this is along Lake Michigan.
Okay, along the coastline, yeah. So they fly, but this generation that does the migrating...
You said generation?
Yes. So, yeah, you're skipping ahead on the story here. But these ones that we have here in the fall that are migrating, they're referred to as the Methuselah generation or the super generation, as opposed to subsequent generations, which we'll get to in a minute. So these guys live a lot longer. They live 8 or 9 months. The other generations, which we'll get to, only live a few weeks. So these ones really are special. They're usually a little larger. So in the fall, you might notice that the monarchs are larger. Well, it's the new generation, the super generation, or larger ones. And they're the ones that have the capability of flying all the way down to a certain mountain range, a few mountain peaks in a certain mountain range in Mexico. And they all funnel down there, unless they're the ones that are going to California. Everything else, including ours here from Michigan, would fly down to this location in Mexico on these mountain slopes, usually on the south and southwest slope. It turns out it's cool enough there. You might think, well, if they're leaving for the cold, why do they want cool? Well, they have to survive the whole winter. And if they're hot and warm, then because they're warm-blooded animals, they're going to need nectar and food, and they'll be very active. So they want it cool, but not freezing like Michigan. And so they have a favorite species of fir tree that they're attracted to. And they spend the winter there all huddled together, millions and millions on the same tree. Enough so that sometimes branches break off because of the weight of the butterflies, if you can imagine that many butterflies.
How close do they stay together? Do they literally warm each other?
Or? They are crammed together. And yes, that provides a bit of insulation and shared body heat. So if you imagine the trunk of a tree, they'd just be stacked there side by side by side with their wings folded up or down. They'll do it either way, but they're just, you can't see the tree trunk.
Wow.
Because of the butterflies that are all there. Now, they survive the winter, hopefully, unless there's a really big freeze or some environmental event that happens, damage of the forest, and we're hoping the forest is maintained there. Then they'll start warming up in the spring. And they'll search for water because they haven't eaten or drank anything this whole time. They're sort of hibernating there. So they kind of migrate and hibernate. So they come out of hibernation and find some flower that has nectar, and that's their energy source in the butterfly stage. And they'll begin to fly back. But they may have come down 3,000 miles, say from Michigan to Mexico. They'll only fly back 200 or 300 miles and then lay their eggs. And they always do that on milkweed plants. We know that they're an obligate to milkweed. So the eggs will hatch, and there's their food supply. They need milkweed. So the parents have the responsibility of laying the eggs on the right plant so that when the little ones hatch, they've got their food. But then this Methuselah generation, the super generation, they die after laying their eggs so that they don't come back to Michigan.
It's a one-way trip.
It's a one-way trip, but they start the process of the return trip through their offspring. So these little eggs will hatch out into larvae, and they'll go through the whole life cycle.
Do they look exactly the same, just smaller?
A little bit smaller, but a monarch is a monarch. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And these guys, when they become adults, and they'll fly a few hundred miles further north towards Michigan or whatever Great Lakes state you're from, and then they'll stop and lay their eggs and die. And then those eggs will develop into butterflies, and the adults will then fly a few hundred more miles north, lay their eggs.
Sounds like a relay race to me.
It is, in a way. And then so finally, after 4 or 5 generations, we get monarchs back here in Michigan. But it's not the monarchs that's left. It's the great-great-grandchildren of the monarchs that left.
How do they know where to go?
therein lies a big dilemma. So there's sort of two questions you're asking there. And one, how do they navigate? How do they find their way? That's one question. And let's deal with that first. It turns out that there's sort of two things that trigger the navigation of these butterflies. So let's say the ones that were in Michigan in the fall flying south. How do they find the Sierra Madre Mountains? Not just the mountains, but the same peaks that their great-great-grandparents came from. Not even that. Oftentimes the same tree trunk in that forest on that mountain. So it's a very precise orientation, and there's a couple of ways this gets accomplished. One is the sun compass, and a lot of living things use the sun compass, and we're able to do that too. You know, the sun rises in the east, and it's overhead at noon, and it goes down in the west. And so you can figure out direction at that point. So you could figure out where south is based on the sun. The problem with that is you have to know the time. If you, you know, woke up out of a stupor and you saw the sun was, you know, is that east or west? You have to know the time. And it turns out that birds and butterflies and a lot of other things are able to tell time within 15 minutes of accuracy.
Really?
Which is way better than I've got to look at my watch. And okay, it was a couple hours ago, it was noon, so maybe it's 2 o'clock, but they're very accurate. And that has to do with, we don't fully understand all of it, but there are pigments in the eyes that respond not just to the individual flashes of light like we use for our main vision, but they just respond to if there's light present. And chemical signals build up in those cells over the whole course of the day. And so they're measuring the amount of time it's been daylight. And from that, they know time, and it's a pretty accurate system. Problem with the sun compass is that's going to take you south. But if you go south from, you know, Quebec in Canada or south from North Dakota, you're going to land up at two very different places. So everything has to funnel down to these mountains, this particular mountain chain in Mexico. And so there's evidence that we've now learned that they use a magnetic compass. So they have a built-in compass. Now, it's not a little red needle with, you know, north and south, but it works very much the same. There are light-sensitive pigments right out in the end of their antenna. If you looked at a butterfly antenna, they have the little knobs on the end. Well, those little knobs are really, really important. And they have little light-sensitive pigments that are also magnetic. Okay, so they respond to light, but they respond to magnetism. And so the butterfly has to be lined up in the right magnetic direction based on the Earth's magnetic field in order to be able to respond to light. So they can sort of detect that it's there because they see with those little antenna, they can only see when they're pointing in the right direction. If they're pointing north or off somewhere else, they don't see as clear as pointing straight ahead.
So it makes me think of horses with these blinders or something.
It's kind of like that, only maybe in reverse. It's keeping them from looking the other direction. They're focused on going forward.
Well, when they've got into it and they see clear, they follow that direction.
Right. It's just a clear picture, so flying that direction. So the combination of the Earth's magnetic field and the time and sun compass, it seems to work. And they can get, you know, quite localized. But you think of our GPS systems now, you can be, you know, 3 or 4 feet off the mark and your GPS can detect it. That's the kind of accuracy they would need to be able to pick up the right tree.
Wow. Talk about redundancy.
It's really a remarkable thing. And sort of one of the implications of this is that, you know, how does the Methuselah generation know how to get there? That instinct that we call it had to be information that was transmitted through the genetics of all of the intermediate generations before it got to them.
Because they didn't get to talk to each other.
They don't get to talk to each other. There's no experience. So this is done without any experience. It's, you know, and yeah, five generations removed from the last time it was tried.
A few things we would think got lost.
Right. So it really is something, and it's a quandary really to think about how that kind of a system operates and is maintained, you know, environment changes, whatever. It's really a remarkable thing. We still have a lot more to learn. One of the problems is that area in Mexico is very inaccessible, both physically.
To humans?
To you. It's in a very remote place. We only found it a few decades ago. It was an unknown thing. But now political instability and geopolitical kinds of things make it very difficult and right now dangerous to be down there. So
sounds like people are getting in the way.
Well, yes, and people are very good at doing that sometimes when it comes to biology. So yeah, there's a lot more to learn, and we just enjoy them in our garden, but there's a huge backstory to how that little butterfly landed up on your daisy.
Well, you know, I think the more you study and we study creation, the marvel just gets to be deeper and more awe, and that's what God's all about, is
that's right. The
awe factor.
And this works so well, but that's because those trees are growing on those mountains right now. You know, historically, was it always that way? Have they had to change and adapt? Do they used to have a much wider range? So there's just so much to the story that it's just, like anything, the more you dig into it, the more questions you have. You answer some questions, but then you've got many more. It's job security in science.
Absolutely. You know, it just, how do people figure these things? I mean, how do you figure out that? How do those scientists even think of testing? What system do you do? See, how do I figure out if it's magnetism or the solar compass or?
Well, I think they got a lot of cues from studying birds, because birds do a lot of these same things. We haven't had a chance to talk yet about the actual navigation of birds. That'll come up in a later episode, but I think we already had some things worked out. Well, of course, then the question is, who decided to try? Sometimes it's just an accident that, you know, you're trying to figure something else and you notice, well, hey, you know, this is sitting beside this, they're acting a little strange, but they're sitting beside this electric motor. And an electric motor, when it's on, is generating a magnetic field. And, oh, I wonder. And so you start testing these things.
Sounds like just sitting there and observing.
That observation is extremely important, even when it's a failed experiment, but your observation of what went on when things went wrong can lead to a lot of new steps forward.
So, wow. What else would you like to tell us?
Well, people often ask the question, you know, how do I attract monarch butterflies? What can I do to help them? Because they are struggling. And there's really two things you can do to attract monarchs in your yard. One of those things is to plant nectar-producing plants. Okay. Because as butterflies, they suck out this sweet nectar from plants. A lot of these flowers that some of them are called butterfly bush, but they have other names, I'm sure. But any of the plants that have these sort of long funnel-like things, like the same thing that attracts hummingbirds, will attract butterflies. So a variety of flowers that produce nectar will attract the adult butterflies. But if you really want to have the butterflies around and have fun watching the development, having a patch of milkweed is also really helpful, because that's where they're going to lay their eggs, where the little larvae will crawl around, and you can watch them grow, and they grow an incredible amount every day. I mean, you can go out each day and see the size difference. And they'll kind of hang around on the same leaf. So if you find a leaf with an egg, keep coming back and you can look at it. And so the combination of nectar-producing flowers for the adults and milkweed for the young ones, that's the best way to attract them. And a lot of other people ask, what is it about milkweed that's so important? Well, it turns out it's food, but it's also a protection for them. So the little ones, the larvae, eat a lot. They're just a chewing machine. I don't know that I've ever seen one just sitting there. Maybe they do, but they seem to always be chewing. And that white milky stuff that you see when you break open a milkweed leaf or a stem, that has some toxins in it that doesn't hurt the little larvae, but apparently tastes really, really bad if one of their predators were to eat it. And so what happens with monarchs is these, each monarch larvae, as it grows bigger and bigger and looks juicier and juicier to maybe, let's say, a blue jay, it's also getting more and more nasty tasting and toxic. And so if a blue jay comes by, snags one and eats it, typically within 15 seconds, the blue jay vomits.
Hmm.
It's that toxic to it. But the blue jay will remember that. And these little larvae, they're very brightly colored in bands of yellow and black and green. The blue jay will never eat another monarch butterfly larvae. The one-time learning thing. So that's another whole fascinating thing, that there's one-time learning in a lot of biology. So that one little caterpillar died, but the rest of that population is now safe from at least that blue jay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Atkins. Next, we will air an on-location recording of a citizen scientist who has been netting monarch butterflies and tagging them for a few decades. This tagging builds a body of knowledge of the monarch butterfly's migration. We will join Keith Calkins on his family farm south of Cadillac, Michigan. We didn't net any monarchs, but we sure learned a lot about the process. Enjoy. Okay, well, take me out to the point of interest.
So I'm glancing at the milkweed to see if there's any caterpillars or any chrysalises. It's getting late in the season. I'm not seeing where it's chewed. I'm not seeing any frass, which would be the technical term for the droppings.
Oh, yeah. I know about frass with my tomato worms.
Yeah. So historically, we had a lot of milkweed, a lot of butterflies out in this area.
Okay.
But the trees have grown up, and so we don't get as much. I think they like the sheltered environment where the trees were kind of 15 feet high, and so you got good sun.
Okay. That makes me think about when we did the Carter blue butterflies, that they like to have more of a prairie or a savanna, they called it. They need to have an open area that if the trees get too tall, they move on. It's not their environment. Well,
these trees have gotten too tall.
And these trees look like they're 30 plus 35 feet tall. They were planted in a rows. In fact, you guys probably put them in.
My father put them in.
How many years ago?
Well, these were about 30 years ago, probably. We're but then we have hardwoods up here, oak, red oak, so they're slower growing.
We're walking a two-track right now as we're walking along. These are, you say elm?
Well, there's walnut.
Walnut, yeah.
There are a couple elm trees we transplanted from the garden, and there's hickory.
How big is this field? Of course, it goes to the north for ways.
Well, my father had 160 acres.
Okay.
But yeah, the road, 20 miles, is just up there.
We're near Tustin, east of Tustin.
This side of that hill, yeah.
Small burg that's along the US 131 freeway. We're looking at the milkweed plants. We're not seeing a lot of evidence that monarchs have been eating.
But we have seen monarchs this week, a mile north of here, flying around the cemetery. So, but it is really cool today. You know, it's below 60.
Butterflies are temperature sensitive?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So the migration is actually triggered by the angle of the sun.
Okay. Inclination, I think they call it.
Yeah.
Now, tell us what you know about monarch butterflies. Are they similar to most migrating butterfly species, or are they same or different?
Well, there's a lot of variation between the butterflies. Like your swallowtail in the garden will overwinter underground, whereas
really?
The monarchs migrate
okay.
in the adult state. So that's a significant difference.
Now, tell us a little bit, Keith, about your experience with the monarchs. How long have you been involved in this? And what is your role?
Over 60 years. I started when the milkweed was taller than I was, collecting them here on the farm, raising them in mayonnaise jars, the caterpillars, and letting them go. About 30 years ago, I started tagging them.
How did that get started?
There's a Monarch Watch group out of Kansas, University of Kansas, Lawrence.
Okay.
And they were studying the monarchs, the migration. They have a program where they pay locals to collect tags down at the hibernation site in Mexico, and they sell these tags, and during the migration, volunteers tag the butterflies.
That's up here in the north.
Well, some of them are further south.
Okay.
You know, because they come through Texas and Kansas and, you know, somewhat through Florida, but it's a funny trip sometimes.
So we've talked with Dr. Atkins, the nature guy, and you may cross over some of the same knowledge, but you know, monarchs are kind of elusive, it seems like. They have multiple legs, or they have multiple generations, the same one. Can you describe that a little in more detail?
Yes. The adults overwinter in Mexico. There's a special forest that they go into and roost on the trees. Extensive.
They roost on top of each other quite deep.
Yeah.
In fact, is it true that sometimes the branches actually break because of the weight of the butterflies?
Could be. They certainly break from the ice storm occasionally, which can be hard on the butterfly population.
Being the fact that they travel from here and north of here, all the way down to Mexico, there's a lot of risk involved, I assume.
Yeah, and they're not very big. They're just a gram or two, you know, takes a lot of them to make an ounce.
Wow.
So the ones that start in the winter, those are the ones that migrated, and they live generally over the winter. Some die, and those are where they find the tags on the forest floor and pick them up, and they pay the locals for them. And come spring, about March or so, they'll start on their migration north. By the time they get to Texas, they will stop and lay eggs. And then that group that hatches out in Texas there in the early spring will produce, you know, that's kind of called the first generation. They'll produce butterflies after, you know, it takes the egg several days to hatch. It takes the caterpillar almost 2 weeks, depends on the temperature again, to develop. And then they're in the chrysalis for, you know, about 10 days, depending on the temperature.
Is their behavior about the same when they go through the chrysalis stages in different locations? I mean, each generation, is the chrysalis stage the same in each generation?
Yes, it is.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But that overwintering population does seem to live extra long.
Yes.
And so that first generation is highly dependent on what the weather is in Texas in the spring, you know, whether there's a lot of rain so that the flowers produce, you know, nectar, and they feed, they migrate north. And, you know, about every month you have another generation. And by August, you can have butterflies well up into Canada. And so then by the beginning of August, those northern monarchs are migrating south.
Now, one thing I learned from Dr. Heather Keough from the U.S. Forest Service is we were looking for milkweeds. This is where they attach to and they eat. But the milkweed stage is a shorter part of their life. That the nectar, the very important is
for the adults.
For the adults is often the overlooked part of when we're trying to help monarchs' population thrive. We need to do the whole thing, including the nectar station.
Yeah, there's a lot of way stations that have been developed, and they almost focus exclusively on the milkweed because, of course, that's where they lay their eggs. The caterpillar eats almost exclusively milkweed. There's different varieties of milkweed.
So not all milkweeds are not the same.
Not all milkweeds are the same, but it's still milkweed.
So
that's what they eat.
We're in northwestern Michigan, north central northwest. Is our milkweed variety pretty much standard here?
Yeah, but there are, like I say, local variations. So by this time of the year, historically, we could expect a frost this early in September. Last summer, we didn't get a frost until the end of September. I looked at the 10-day forecast. We don't have a frost forecast for the next 10 days. So it's this generation that can make or break the population.
This is because, the vulnerable one, huh?
Right, because if they are laying eggs now, they probably won't have time to emerge before the weather turns to cold. So they'll freeze out and won't be able to make the journey south. So, but yeah, it's not a sunny day, so we're not seeing a lot of activity.
Not a lot of flight.
And it's not a warm day. I think we had a north wind, which would help them on their southern journey.
Okay.
But just in case, because we did see some earlier in the week, a mile north, we've been seeing them in not in directed flight. It's been in just flirting around
locally,
finding nectar.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit further about your lifelong interests and what have you gained over these years. You had the childhood curiosity, I assume, and it bloomed and you got connected up with this group that's doing the research. What are different stages that you've learned over the years?
Well, I'm happy that some of the monarchs that I tagged,
okay,
those tags were found in Mexico. So I have about 6 certificates.
All right.
For monarchs that their tags were found. And I kind of started back in on it when my boys were small. All right. And so that 30 years is kind of a, you know, they're 33 and 30. So yeah, I've been interested in science. I want my boys to be involved and interested in science. And so the monarch is just one of the conservation things that I got involved in.
Well, Keith, I want to thank you very much for our adventure. I'm Tom Azure, and we've been at the Calkins Farm here outside of Tustin. And just wait to see what we do next time on another Strong Tower Radio adventure.
You have been listening to a monarch butterfly double feature. We first heard biologist Dr. Gordon Atkins share key features of this amazing monarch butterfly migration, followed by Keith Calkins, who with many others have been tagging monarch butterflies to build a body of knowledge to help assist this wonderful species. I'm your host, Tom Azure, for Strong Tower Radio Feature. Bye now.